Welcome back to the special edition of the Business of Government Hour, a conversation with authors exploring national security, power, and intelligence in the 21st century. I'm Michael Keegan, your host, and our guest today is Professor Joseph Nye, author of The Future of Power. Also joining us today from IBM is Frank Strickland. Professor Nye, what is soft power? And more particularly, what are the three basic resources that are essential to a country's soft power prowess?
Well, on the soft power dimension, it grows largely out of a country's culture, its values when a country lives up to its values, and from its policies when the policies are seen as legitimate in the eyes of others. So sometimes you can find that a country will have values which are attractive, but policies which at least temporarily are unattractive. I'll give you an example of this. In the Vietnam War, there were massive demonstrations around the world against American government policy. We were very unpopular at the time. But the interesting thing is that the people who were demonstrating in the streets were not singing the Communist Internationale. They were singing Martin Luther King's We Shall Overcome. So there was an attractiveness about one aspect of American culture, our ability to be self-critical and to protest ourselves, which made people attracted to the United States, even though the government's policies in the Vietnam War were very unattractive. So we were able to, we lost soft power from our policies. We gained soft power from our culture and values. What that suggests is a lot of soft power comes not just from government, but from civil society. In the United States case, it comes from everything from our universities to Hollywood to the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation and so forth. That's producing attraction for the United States even at times when the American government policies are not always popular.
So what role does public diplomacy play in the conveyance of soft power?
Well, public diplomacy is important. It's one of the things the government can do. In other words, I'm not implying the government can do nothing, but public diplomacy is the ability to communicate with the populations rather than just the governments of other countries. That can take the classical form of broadcasting. It also can take the form of exchanges, of meeting people and talking. And in fact, in some ways, exchanges may be more important. Edward R. Murrow, the famous American broadcaster, once said that of the communicating among humans across vast distances, it's the last 3 feet that's most important, meaning the face-to-face relationship. So when we bring foreign leaders to the United States, which the government funds, that's often more important than some of our broadcasts. And similarly, when you have, as we do, 750,000 foreign students in the United States, not each of them goes home absolutely convinced about the United States, but studies show that the vast majority of them do. So those are dimensions of public diplomacy in the case of bringing in foreign leaders or Fulbright programs which support foreign students and so forth, where I think the government does play a significant role.
Would you explain the concept of smart power, and particularly to what extent does it seek to integrate and network diplomacy, defense, and development?
Well, smart power simply means the ability to combine hard and soft power into effective strategies in different contexts. And if you look at basically the policy statements of the Obama administration, there is a strong desire to integrate, in this case, the hard power capacities of the Defense Department and the softer power capacities of the State Department. If you go back to 2007, when Secretary of Defense Gates was still in the Bush administration, he went out to Kansas City and gave the Landon speech, in which he said the United States needs to do more in soft power. He said, we in the military can't solve all the problems that we face. We need a stronger partner in the State Department. And he said it may seem odd for a Secretary of Defense to come out here and ask for resources for state, but he said that's the way the world is. And when Hillary Clinton became Secretary of State, she basically made smart power, as she called it, using all the tools in our toolbox, a component of her strategy. And Admiral Mike Mullen, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, has also talked about the need to use soft power and hard power in combination. So those are examples of top leaders who have talked about smart power and are trying to do something about it. The trouble is that it's very hard to overcome decades and decades of institutional inertia. The government in the United States consists of a giant, the Defense Department, and a lot of pygmies in terms of budgetary capacity. And that means that trying to integrate programs in state and defense is not easily done. In addition to that, in American political culture, it's very hard to get people to support soft power investments. For example, a congressperson, a friend of mine, said that she agreed with me about soft power, but it was easy to stand up on the political stump and urge investments into the Defense Department, very hard to urge investments in the State Department. And the net result of that is that we're not very well balanced. It's easier to say this than it is to actually integrate these vast departments.
To what extent is the global information revolution and the diffusion of power cause for the application of smart power?
Well, we can't really deal with a lot of the problems that we face from this bottom chessboard of transnational relations without the cooperation of others. How do you cope with, let's say, cyber terrorism? If you don't know who's attacked you, where do you send the cruise missile in response? Or if you're going back to my example of climate change, if China is putting all the CO2 and others as well into the atmosphere, how do you move them if you can't move them by military means? So in that sense, the diffusion of power, which is creating these new transnational processes, is creating a lot of new threats and challenges to us, which we can't use our traditional instruments to solve. Sometimes the United States is a little bit like a little boy with a hammer. A little boy with a hammer sees everything in the world as a nail. And the United States has a wonderful hammer on the top chessboard of military power. But that doesn't mean that the kinds of issues that we're dealing with on the bottom chessboard of transnational relations are nails. They're usually quite the contrary. They're amorphous and difficult to hammer.
Well, Professor Nye, relative to that point, would you elaborate a bit on an American smart power strategy and some of the questions that a successful smart power strategy needs to answer?
Well, one of the things that a smart power strategy has to pay attention to is narrative. Though there's what I said earlier about whose story wins. And that means, for example, when President Obama was deciding whether or not to intervene in Libya, that one of the primary considerations that he had to take into account was what was the story going to be. If he had simply intervened unilaterally before there were any resolutions approving it, the story would have been American imperialists once again attack a Muslim country. And that would have reverberated from Morocco to Indonesia. Instead of that, he said he was not going to intervene until you had a resolution from the Arab League and the UN. So the story became U.S. joins others in intervening in Libya to protect civilians, which gives you a very different type of story, which is much more beneficial for our soft power rather than harming our soft power. In addition to that, he was very careful to make sure that he was willing to share the lead, letting the French, British, and others take the lead, and to make sure that NATO, a multilateral institution, was the operational locus for the activity. That's an example of a smart power strategy in the sense that the decision maker, in this case the president, thought through what is the effect on my soft power of certain uses of my hard power, and how can I put them together in an integrated smart power strategy. I don't mean this to be a partisan point. I mean, I would cite Obama because he has recently carried out, I think, a smart strategy in the way he handled his Libyan policy. But you can think back to the two Bush presidencies. George H.W. Bush was very careful to make sure that he had UN resolution, but also Arab participation in the coalition that defeated Saddam Hussein in 1991. Why? He didn't need the Arabs to defeat Saddam Hussein. Syria and Egypt didn't contribute much at all to the military victory. They contributed a lot to the legitimacy of the operation, which affected the soft power, so that the United States was seen as leading a broad international coalition. In contrast, George W. Bush, who's about as closely related genetically as we'll get the test case of two presidents, when he couldn't get a second UN resolution and couldn't get a broad coalition, went in anyway. And that turned out to be very expensive for American soft power, and we're still paying the costs of that to this day.
Smart power seems to rely on a more patient and nuanced approach than perhaps just relying on hard power alone. And yet, political leaders, especially in nation states, have pressures that they face from constituencies, from the media, to deliver results. And hard power can sometimes be perceived as delivering results more decisively or faster than the more patient and nuanced approach. How would you advise leaders on managing the tension between these two?
Well, it is difficult because political leaders are, particularly in the House of Representatives, are elected every 2 years. So if you say strategy one will produce a result now, and strategy two, which might be more cost-effective but won't produce a result until 4 years from now or 5 years from now, if your election is 2 years from now, you want strategy one. And that's a problem that we face in our democracy. On the other hand, if you think back, President Eisenhower, who really was a very good foreign policy president, was very clear on this. He often said, I want things that will deal with exchanges that may not pay off for quite some time, but will have an ultimate payoff. So, for example, Eisenhower supported exchange programs with students from the Soviet Union and the United States. And there were many people opposed this. The most of the security bureaucracy said, no, the Soviets will just send KGB agents and steal us blind. And Eisenhower said, we're going to go ahead anyway. What's interesting is, yeah, the Soviets did send KGB agents, but they also sent some people who basically were crucial in later phases of Soviet development. One of those was a man named Alexander Yakovlev, who went to Columbia University in the late 50s and studied with David Truman, a political scientist who was interested in pluralism. And what's intriguing is Yakovlev didn't become a defector or stay. He went back home, rose quietly through the ranks. But when Gorbachev's generation came to power, Yakovlev was his right-hand man in urging perestroika and glasnost. Well, that's quite a return on the investment. I don't know what that scholarship cost back in the 50s. It probably, I doubt it was much more than $10,000 or $20,000 in those dollars of that day. But if you ask in contribution toward the end of the Soviet Union, which was something which was a major objection, which cost us billions and billions of dollars to try to accomplish, that was a very good investment.
How is power diffusion changing the game? We will ask Professor Joseph Nye, author of The Future of Power, when our conversation continues on the Business of Government Hour.